Welcome to Off the Grid Radio. Better ideas to bust you and your family out of today's global control grid. Now, here's today's show.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Off the Grid Radio. I'm Michael Faust of OffTheGridNews.com. World War II is full of survival stories, but there is one particularly harrowing one set in winter that wasn't fully told until the past year. Here's the background. Shortly before Christmas in 1943, five Army aviators left Alaska's Ladd Field on a routine flight to test their B-24 Liberator in harsh winter conditions. That plane crashed, leaving all but one of them dead. That lone survivor, a man by the name of Leon Crane, survived the crash with little more than a parachute and an old Boy Scout knife in his pocket. He survived for 12 weeks in the Yukon wilderness, enduring snow, ice, wind, and sub-zero temps. And his story is now recounted in a book. It's called 81 Days Below Zero, and author Brian Murphy takes us on an amazing tale of survival and determination. It's an inspirational story that would be unbelievable if it weren't true. And Murphy is this week's guest on Off the Grid Radio. But first, let's talk about today's sponsor. Today's sponsor is MySolarBackup.com. Discover how to get free off-grid electricity that you can use even when your neighbor's power is out. It's like having a secret power plant hidden right in your home. That's MySolarBackup.com. Brian, we really enjoy reading your book. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure.
What got you involved in this book? What attracted you to this story?
Well, I mean, there was kind of two parts to it. I'll get into how I first found out about the story, which was a very kind of indirect way, as writers tend to stumble upon things. Back in 2007, so quite a while ago, 9 years ago, I just stumbled across a press release from the Pentagon, from the Defense Department, talking about the burial of a World War II serviceman at Arlington National Cemetery. And as I was reading it, they had one line sort of tucked in the middle of the press release saying four members of this plane died, the folks you mentioned earlier in the intro.
Sure.
One survived, and he walked out of the Alaskan wilderness after nearly 3 months lost.
Good gracious.
I said, my gosh. So I said, I want to read this book. I hunted around. There was no book, so I took it upon myself to do it. So that's the story of how I came across it. But the larger question you asked about, you know, what it meant to do this story, I thought was really fascinating because, again, it's Alaska was among the many fronts in World War II, often a kind of forgotten front. But in addition to the survival story, which is remarkable in its own right, it was a chance to have a window into this very interesting world of Alaska during World War II, which included this back channel supply route to the Soviets via Siberia. So there was there was a lot more to this book than just the story itself.
Sure. I should tell our audience, Brian writes for the Washington Post, and I should also say this is a nonfiction book. This is kind of kudos to you, Brian. This is a nonfiction book that reads kind of like a novel. That's the best kind of nonfiction book I think we can read. It's also the hardest to write, I think, as well. Tell us who Leon Crane was. Take us back to 1943, because that's the person, of course, that's the subject of the book.
Right. Well, Leon. We're talking about him in the context of Alaska, but really this was a guy from Philadelphia. All his sensibilities were East Coast urban sensibilities. He grew up in the neighborhood of West Philadelphia. He studied aviation engineering at MIT. He enlisted in the Army Air Corps shortly before Pearl Harbor. He was stationed in Ohio, among other places. But I mention all this because Alaska to him was really a unknown place. The weather was not familiar with him. Everything was out of place for him. So he was stationed at Ladfield outside of Fairbanks. Mm. And what they were doing with this plane, among many different aspects of what the space was doing, but this was used as a place for cold weather testing of planes and equipment, but mostly planes. So they were sending up test pilots to do various, you know, kind of shutting down engines, doing various diagnostic tests, checking the hydraulics and so forth, with all different types of aircraft. The B-24 was the one that Leon was in. And so they were on nothing in the Alaska skies in the winter is routine, of course, but this was just a mission to do something called prop feathering, which means you shut down one of the props, adjust the blades to get it most aerodynamic, so if an engine fails, you don't have a lot of wind drag. So they were doing that, and the plane stalled, went into this spin that they couldn't get out of, and Leon, who was the co-pilot, managed to get his chute on and bail out. Another fellow crew member got out before him, but certainly perished, and we can get into that a bit if you want.
Sure.
But anyway, so in other words, this was a guy who was, on paper anyway, very out of his element.
Yeah, this is not Bear Grylls in the middle of Alaska. This is a guy from Philadelphia. And I guess I should ask you before I answer the question, did this guy have many winter survival skills that he had been trained for?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
I mean, they, you know, what they would be doing with the pilots assigned to Alaska and probably other cold weather locales, they would give them a very cursory bit of training, but mostly it involves staying close to a crash site, you know, trying to conserve energy, but nothing, no special techniques, kind of common sense type thing.
So when they crashed, how many miles were they from Ladfield, the airbase?
They were about, in a direct line, probably about 100 miles. Mm. But what complicated this on a number of levels, but let's talk about Leon Crane specifically, that he didn't really know where he was. He had a vague idea that they were south of the Yukon River, but he didn't have any clue of his coordinates. And this, you know, as he was plotting what he was going to do, this factored in as well, because he had no idea if he was 5 miles or 50 miles or even farther from a civilization or some kind of outpost.
And what complicates it even more, you said Fairbanks earlier, and every time I hear the word Fairbanks, I think extreme cold. And so what are we talking about where he crashed? Was it, how cold was it?
Well, when he bailed out of the plane at that altitude, it was probably about minus 70.
Wow.
The day that he, December 21st, 1943, that day in that area of the Alaska Yukon was probably around minus 30, maybe close to minus 40. Mm. The thing that saved him in some respects, and I think it's the reason that Fairbanks can even exist as a city and people live there, is it tends to be not very windy. So they had this, you know, incredible cold weather, but without the compounded factor of wind chill. So again, super cold, but he was able to, you know, at least find some shelter under trees and mm-hmm. and build a fire. And the reason he was able to build a fire was an incredible stroke of luck. And I can discuss that if you want.
Yeah, let's get on that in a second. But I just want to set this up again for people who are still catching up with the story. We're talking to Brian Murphy, the author of 81 Days Below Zero. So we have a guy from Philadelphia who doesn't have any winter survival skills. He's 100 miles east or 100 miles from the base, crashes in the middle of the Yukon, territory, and it's you know, what did you say 40 below, I think is what you said.
40 below, right?
Yeah, 40 below. And he has a parachute, a pocket knife, and some matches. Now, why did he have matches?
This, again, was an incredible stroke of luck, and it kind of shows how your life maybe can pivot on something that seems inconsequential at the time. The pilot, again, Leon was the co-pilot, the pilot smoked a pipe, and he just had this reputation of never having a lighter, never having a light, always bumming a light. And at the last minute, very much a spur-of-the-moment thing, Leon grabbed two packs of matches, threw them in his parka, and was going to surprise the pilot during the flight or the way home with the matches, because he knew he wouldn't have a light for his pipe. So just because of that gesture, he ended up with two packs of matches, and that was certainly a lifesaver.
And I think we should also mention that this area, you know, when we get this far north, you know, close to the Arctic Circle as we are, we're talking, I guess, what, 3 or 4 days of sunlight a day during this time?
Yeah, it was less than 4 hours of daylight. And even the daylight that time of year, bear in mind, this was the shortest day of the year that he crashed, you know, officially the first day of winter. And even the daylight then is very hazy, milky. It's not the type of strong sun that you imagine at lower altitudes.
How did the parachute help him survive? What did he use? You know, what did he do with the parachute that helped him survive those first few days?
Well, as expected, you know, he sensed immediately that the parachute was an essential part of his survival. This wasn't even part of the training, but you know, it was kind of an obvious thing. So what he did after he got a fire going was essentially cocooned himself in the parachute, and he would get up to melt some snow or crack into the ice to get water, tend the fire. But mostly he stayed wrapped up in this parachute. They were made of silk, and silk is a very good insulating material, so it was kind of a double help for him. He not only had the chute to wrap himself in, but silk is really good at insulating against the cold.
And so he survived. We'll get in the second part of the program, we'll talk about, you know, his stroke of luck or fortune or providence, whatever you want to call it. But for 7 or 8 days, he stayed right in that area, didn't he?
He did. And what he was hoping for was a search and rescue plane coming over, maybe seeing his fire, but certainly seeing the crash. And to set this up for your listeners, the crash site was on top of a hill, and then there's a slope down to a frozen river. He was along this river called the Charlie River. So he was next to the river. The plane crash was far up on a hill. It was the snow was too deep, and the terrain was too unstable for him to reach the plane. But what had happened during this flight is they failed to do one of their radio checks before the plane went into its spin. So the rescuers didn't really have a good marker. They hadn't checked in for nearly an hour, which meant that they could have been, you know, literally anywhere.
Yeah.
Because during this mission, they didn't have a special flight plan. They just said, go up and find a good place to do your testing. So once he realized after about a week that there was no plane, he knew no one was coming looking for him.
Mm. And I already know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask you anyway, just so you can tell everybody. What did he eat that first week?
Nothing.
Yeah.
he had water, as I mentioned, which of course is important. Despite the incredible cold there, the river was flowing fast enough that there were weak spots in the ice. He could chip that, and it kind of bubbled up through these holes, so he was able to drink water. He tried with very, very, not even coming close, to success to try to hunt some of the squirrels, which are some of the few animals that that don't hibernate during the winter. But for about a week, longer than a week actually, he only had water and that was it.
All right, we need to take a quick break, Brian. When we return, let's continue the story looking at the fortuitous, even providential event that helped this man survive. We'll be right back.
Have you ever wanted to generate your own supply of electrical power? If so, this is going to be the most important message you will ever hear. Solar power generators are now available from Solutions from Science in Thompson, Illinois. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving electrical power when you need it most. Unlike gas generators, a solar generator runs quietly, emits no fumes, and produces electricity for free. It's like having an electric power plant running quietly in your own home. Run sump pumps, shortwave radios, computers, and even keep food from spoiling. Whether it's hurricanes, ice storms, brownouts, or blackouts, you'll never have to suffer through painful power outages again. When the power goes out, you'll be ready. With a solar-powered generator from Solutions from Science, go to mysolarbackup.com and get off the grid today. That's mysolarbackup.com or call 877-327-0365. 877-327-0365. Don't wait. Call today.
Hi, this is Michael Faust of Off-The-Grid Radio and OffTheGridNews.com. Are you listening to us on iTunes and like what you hear? Then help us and your fellow off-gridders out by rating us. That will help boost our rankings in iTunes so that other off-gridders, homesteaders, and anyone else in the self-sufficient community can discover us. It takes less than 30 seconds. As always, thanks for listening to Off-The-Grid Radio.
Off-The-Grid News, because you want a different paradigm.
Brian, before the break, we were mentioning that you know, Leon had this amazing event happen that helped him stay alive. What exactly happened? He found a cabin, and how did the cabin help, and why in the world was the cabin even there?
Well, what he decided after more than a week, around day nine, that no one was coming. And as I mentioned earlier, he knew he was south of the Yukon River, but had no idea how far south. So his idea, which was a very sound and logical one, was follow the river. It'll eventually lead to the Yukon River, and that will eventually lead to a settlement or a town. So he starts walking along this frozen river. Again, in very bad shape. His hands were getting close to stage three frostbite, which is almost irreversible. At the point of starvation, and he stumbled across very near death. Stumbled across this cabin, and as you mentioned, it was stocked with supplies. And in the tradition of Alaska, but also many places with remote areas, the owner would leave supplies there just in case someone in need came by, and in this case, it was a life-saving gesture.
And we're talking supplies such as what?
Well, they had a 22 caliber rifle with ammunition, which played a really important role later, but immediately there were things like sugar, hot cocoa, raisins, non-perishable food, mittens, which I think I failed to mention this earlier, but to compound all these things, Leon Crane had left his mittens on the plane, so he didn't have any protective for his hands.
Oh, wow.
So there were some moose hide mittens, flour, pancake mix, things like that.
Amazing. And so then he gets all that out of the cabin, and I think at one point I guess he's pretty positive right now. He's encouraged. He thinks this could be near civilization, but it's not. Just as you said, this is a remote cabin that's just there.
Exactly. And this factored into what we said earlier about his perspective and sensibilities from being an urban kid. He couldn't imagine that a cabin would just be apart from everything. So he thought it must be like effectively
the edge of the village.
The edge of a village,
yeah.
Exactly. So after just one day, he grabs a handful of raisins, didn't even look through all the supplies, thinking, hey, I'm saved. And he sets off thinking there's going to be a village around the next corner of the river. And this almost proves fatal. He runs into some incredibly harsh weather and walks for about 24 hours, 12 hours out and 12 hours back to the cabin. Mm. And again, this was almost a fatal miscalculation.
You write in your book at this point, you say, he would not be saved. There was no village, no easy way home. He was alone. Suddenly, Crane felt the vastness of the wilderness again. This time, though, it was not to marvel at the stars or the shimmering northern lights. He now felt only small, vulnerable, and scared. I guess one question I have is, why didn't he just stay in that cabin until warm weather hit and just, you know, he would be fine then in terms of walking through the wilderness? Why didn't he stay there until warm weather?
Well, I think there was a practical reason and a psychological reason. The practical reason was after a week or so there was a relative warming spell. And again, relative is an underlined word here. It got maybe close to zero, but even that change in temperature shifted the river ice. And so he kept thinking that if he waited till spring, he knew there was huge floods because of the runoff, the melting snow. And he was thinking it might be actually worse in the spring because he didn't know if the cabin would be on the edge of the floodwaters. And, you know, it could be more complicated in the spring than the winter. At least this was his thinking. But the psychological part, I think, also wore on him too. He realized, and which was true, of course, that the military, his family, his friends were considering him dead, and he was, especially with his family, was really burdened by this idea that that they were mourning him and he couldn't do anything about it.
Amazing. The book is 81 days below zero. We're talking to Brian Murphy. One or two more small questions and then we'll have to let you go here, Brian. Obviously, he, as the book describes, his eventual way out of this situation was, you know, many weeks later, he found another cabin. And that cabin actually was occupied. How many days or how many miles did he have to walk?
He walked a total of certainly more than 100 miles.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to gauge precisely, but anywhere between 100 and 115 to 120 miles. Mm-hmm. And again, when we're talking about that that distance, we also have to keep in mind the weather, but there were also times he fell into the river a couple times. And again, not every day, but, you know, very frequently he had brushes with death until he was lucky enough to find that cabin that was near the mouth of the Yukon. So the crash site was about 100 miles south of the Yukon. Again, he didn't have any idea about that until he walked it.
Falling into the river. I was amazed when I read that because he did what you're supposed to do, which is strip down and get warm by a fire if possible. So I was amazed that he knew what to do there, because some of I think one of the instincts is not to strip clothes because
exactly.
You know you're in the cold weather. One thing I wanted to say here is ask you is how did this. This ordeal change, or did this ordeal change how the military taught its people, or even how they equipped their people?
Well, this, I mean, not specifically Crane's ordeal, but stories like this one. It fits into a larger effort by the military at the time, because World War II was really the first major war that had very cold weather fronts. So the military was quickly rewriting their rule book about equipment, survival techniques, and so forth. So what they did learn from Crane's experience, and probably others as well, is he was one of the first airmen to be issued down parkas. He had a down flight suit. Mm-hmm. Before they had different materials, wool and various things. But they learned from his experience that down was really the way to go. And this was again part of this much broader effort that is still going on today. The military still has many labs and proving grounds for cold weather environments, and this was the early days of the military looking into this.
This book, although it's a nonfiction telling of an amazing story, I think, Brian, actually could serve to teach many people, you know, how to survive in this situation. Would you agree that it's also, I mean, even though you wrote it, but even though it's a book written by yourself, there's lots of survival lessons here, wouldn't you agree?
Oh, I definitely agree. And I think one of the big takeaways for me and others that have read it is, as you mentioned, him falling in the river. Crane's, he was not a person prone to panic. I think his engineering background gave him a very methodical problem-solving approach to things. And probably more than anything else, and I hope I never have to use it myself, yeah, but I'm glad I have this knowledge that not panicking, thinking your way through problems goes a huge way, especially in a cold weather scenario like this, where one false move can set off a chain reaction of things that you might not be able to pull back from. So this methodical, very calculating approach that he did, I think intuitively, and it's just part of his personality, was a really important aspect of his survival.
The book is 81 Days Below Zero. It's an amazing survival book with an amazing story, incredible story about a World War II hero who survived 81 days in the wilderness, walked more than 100 miles. Brian, it's been great talking to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
Our sponsor today was MySolarBackup.com. Discover how to get free off-grid electricity even when your neighbor's electricity is out. It's like having a secret power plant hidden right in your home. That's MySolarBackup.com. Visit OffTheGridNews.com for the best off-grid news and features and tips you'll find anywhere. Our team of experts has written thousands of stories on every facet of off-grid living and survival living. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Keywords, Off The Grid News. Please join us again next week for another edition